Medical advancements have made it possible for people to live much longer, but Dr. Ira Byock argues living longer does not always mean living better. In The Best Care Possible, A Physician's Quest to Transform Care Through the End of Life, he explains that it's harder than ever to be seriously ill and dying in this country. And he proposes ways to reform the healthcare system to improve how we approach terminal illness and death. Dr. Byock is the Director of Palliative Medicine at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in New Hampshire and a professor at Dartmouth Medical School. His book is published by Avery, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what is palliative care, and when did it become a medical specialty?
Palliative care is a team approach to focusing on patients and families who are living with life-threatening illness or injury. It really focuses on people's comfort and quality of life as they work with other doctors to fight the disease that's causing their, you know, life to be threatened.
How is it related to hospice care?
Well, you know, we're of the same lineage. In America, palliative care actually grew up out of a hospice base back in the 1970s. Actually, hospice grew up as a countercultural movement, as a response to people dying badly, often in hospitals, too often in pain, not infrequently alone. And palliative care, frankly, was driven, I must admit, by the nurses. Nurses said this is not okay, and gradually a few doctors, those of us who are doctors, joined them and really began to both respond to deficiencies in human caring through the end of life, but also provide solutions and really develop protocols and now have developed the science behind good palliation.
Is your title, The Best Care Possible, a bit sarcastic?
Not at all. Actually, it's a phrase that I use with almost every patient and family I first meet. I say, I want to give you the best care possible. But in order to do so, I need to know more about who you are as a person. The best care involves not only the treatment of your disease, but also treatment and comfort, care for your comfort and quality of life and support for your family. Best care possible is not one thing. What's right for you may not be right for me or someone down the street. In order to do that, we really need to know about who you are and your values and preferences. The best care also may change over time as a condition either gets better or worse.
Well, how much of this is based on doctors' own prejudices? There's a film in an ICU, I think Frederick Weissman did it, in which two people are terminally ill, and the doctors seem to be encouraging the poor Hispanic man's family to let him die while they are really pressuring the wife of a much-loved physician to do everything possible to keep him alive, even though she thinks that he's in pain and would prefer to die.
I haven't seen the film, but it absolutely describes what I see frequently in terms of other issues than what is the real preferences of each individual and family sometimes cloud decision-making. A lot of what we do in palliative care, I and our team at Dartmouth Hitchcock, is within this cutting-edge medical center where the critical care physicians or the oncologists or the cardiologists are fighting people's disease. We work with them and their families to sort through the complex conditions and decisions that often confront them.
Don't most people expect medical care to heal them? Do you think patients have an unrealistically high expectation for what a doctor can do?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we've learned over the course of the 20th century, we've learned that more is better. Unfortunately, it's a problem. We live in utterly unprecedented times. We have now the prowess to cure many diseases, even cancers. Are often 40% or more of cancers are cured, but And for those who live with cancer, it's often become a chronic disease. Heart disease used to kill people very quickly. Now people live with congestive heart failure for sometimes decades and often quite well. The problem is that we've yet to make even one person immortal. So what happens is that we continue to accumulate what's now been called the burden of disease. And people in their 70s and 80s often are living with, you know, several different diagnoses, Parkinson's disease, a little congestive heart failure, some osteoarthritis, maybe some spinal stenosis, hypertension, not uncommonly. And all of that is a good thing. But since we're mortals, at some point in the course of someone's life, more disease treatment does not equal better care.
Do you think that healthcare falls short when it comes to delivering bad news about a terminal illness? Do doctors inure themselves to having to deal with those kinds of things?
I think that's true, and it's not because doctors are insensitive. I can say this now for the last 8 or 9 years been a medical educator. I think the medical education system is failing young physicians. I think they come to medical school and in their training with high ideals. They frankly come with the right values, the ones that I get to meet. But we teach them to be diseaseologists. We have a disease treatment system in America. We don't have a health care system. And my challenge to the health care system is to walk and chew gum at the same time. We have to bring cutting-edge treatments to diseases and help people live longer, but we have to realize that people eventually will die and bring the same commitment to quality to that last stage of life that we do to every other phase of medical care.
I knew someone who was dying in a hospital, and suddenly she felt abandoned by her oncologist, who she had worked with so closely. She didn't show up at the end of this woman's life.
It's tragic, but I hear stories like that a lot. I think that for that to be okay within the medical profession, it shows where one of the deficiencies are. You know, you can measure things like continuity of care with doctors. You can ask and ascertain from patients what health systems, hospitals or larger health systems provide continuity of care, and as a contrary, what ones are most associated with people feeling somewhat abandoned. That's not good care. That's not good quality. And I frankly, as a physician, I feel bad for the patient. I also feel bad for the physician who didn't have the opportunity, which I find really satisfying, to care for people through the end of life.
Well, this is a famous oncologist, no names mentioned, at a top hospital here in New York. Is this typical?
I think, again, and I think it's particularly apparent in New York. We're diseaseologists. I think in New York, the old Woody Allen line is that, we think dying is optional. And we just – here's the deal. When you or someone you love is seriously ill, the worst thing you can imagine is that you might die or they might die. Unfortunately, I know that there are worse things than having someone you love die. Most basically, it's having someone you love die badly.
In terrible pain.
Suffering as they die, perhaps tethered to machines for days or even weeks in an ICU. And I would say the only thing perhaps worse than all of that is, in retrospect, realizing that much of their suffering was unnecessary and could have been avoided.
My guest is Dr. Ira Byock. His book, The Best Care Possible, A Physician's Quest to Transform Care Through the End of Life. End-of-life care has become a polarizing political issue in recent years. We had the Terry Schiavo case in the debate over health care reform. Sarah Palin and others said that there would be government-sponsored death panels that made decisions about what kind of medical care would be approved for terminal patients and the elderly. Where does all of this stuff come from?
Well, it's just poppycock. I think that was just election year politics and a short-term political tactic by Sarah Palin and Chuck Grassley and some others to fight Obamacare. It really wasn't consistent with even social conservative values. So, I'm a lifelong political progressive, Leonard, and I got to tell you, I have good friends among the social conservatives. Evangelicals clearly make a distinction between killing someone, which they're obviously against, and allowing someone to die naturally. There is no culture war here. Let me say, there is a mirage of a culture war. It turns out, however, that on both sides of the political poles on issues of how we die, there isn't a chasm. We stand on a plateau of high common ground that actually separates feuding factions in this so-called culture war.
But just as some people worry about healthcare rationing, others worry that there can sometimes be too much medical intervention to save a patient who's dying. And I remember Richard Lamb, when he was governor of Colorado, suggested that if the elderly really cared about the rest of us, they wouldn't insist on being kept alive when they were seriously ill because it was such a drain on our finances.
Yeah, I think
he got into trouble for that.
I think it's wrong. I don't think it's necessary. I really do think that this concept of simply staying focused on what the best care possible is for each individual and family through the course of an illness, that means eventually that you want, when I talk to people, they want in general, the large majority of people want all the medical treatments they can have as to help them live as long and as well as possible. But if I ask them, how does this story end? They all want eventually, when it's their time, to die gently. Well, you have to make preparation for that, too. If we're too afraid of upsetting somebody to talk about how this story ends, and if they want to die gently, what does that look like? If we don't make it possible, if we don't extend our commitment to that, too, then so many people die in ICUs. 20% of Americans now die in ICUs. Over 50% of people in New York City die in hospitals. If that's where they want to be, and that's been the result of individualized decision making, it's perfect. But for many people who would rather be at home,
that makes it sound like hospitals are dangerous.
It can be. I think it is dangerous to die in a hospital, frankly. I think the hospitals are good for disease treatment. I think that, frankly, we know it's not just an allegation on my part. The Institute of Medicine has pointed up serious deficiencies in care that people in a hospital get through the end of life.
You write about Jean, the mother of your friend Michelle. What was her situation?
Well, Jean Guider was a prominent physician in South Miami, actually grew up in Brooklyn, and had, as a family physician, had written down exactly what she wanted at the end of life. She was a single person. Her daughter, Michelle, who's a close friend of mine, is a very powerful person, owns her own company right here in Manhattan. In fact, she had all of her mother's advance directives. She asked me what she should do to help care for her mother as Dr. Guider was gradually becoming affected by dementia. So Michelle had all of the numbers, she had made an appointment with her mother's doctor down in Miami to have it all down. But when her mother became sick and had stomach pains and began vomiting, she was sent to an emergency department from an Alzheimer's unit. And when Michelle got the call, her mother had been in an emergency department for nearly 24 hours, was already bruised by being strapped down to a gurney, and nobody had looked at the chart. Now, nobody was at fault here, actually. Everybody in the medical system there was acting with good intention. But notice that when the protocols kicked in, they were all looking at the disease treatment. When Michelle finally got the call and found the doctor on call for her mother's doctor and said, you know, my mother wants none of this, he said, you know, well, I guess we should send her to a hospice program. At least he got that right.
But then she received an astronomical medical bill, even though she had been told that Medicare would pay for it.
Well, she got this enormous bill about 4 weeks after her mother's death for something like $25,000. And when she called up the billing department and said, there's no way we're paying. My mother wanted none of this. We had clearly documented that all of this was to be avoided. The billing clerk said, oh, don't worry. Medicare will pay. In fact, Leonard, Medicare shouldn't pay for that bill. That was bad quality care. That's the sort of thing that needs to get a line so that doctors stop being rewarded and health systems stop being rewarded for doing things that aren't truly person-centered.
My guest is Dr. Ira Byock, B-Y-O-C-K. His book, The Best Care Possible, A Physician's Quest to Transform Care Through the End of Life. It's published by Avery. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But you write that job satisfaction among physicians is at an all-time low. Is it because of what we've been discussing or because of the fight over who gets paid and how do you deal with insurance companies
and
all that stuff?
Keep going. You're right on all the points.
Doctors are hiring people just to talk to insurance companies these
days.
It's awful.
It's just awful. The health system in so many ways is broken. I think doctors and even more nurses, particularly in oncology and critical care, are feeling some sense of moral distress. People don't want to be dead, and doctors don't want their patients to die. But this darn thing called mortality is a little bit like gravity. You know, eventually, despite working against it, it will have its way with you. And what happens often these days is we've sort of invented in this country chronic critical illness. So many people are in ICUs for such long periods of time. For many Americans, it's become a rite of passage. And it is, in fact, demoralizing for doctors and nurses who, after all, want to save lives. We celebrate life. We affirm life. To see people who are really getting care at their own, usually, insistence or their family's insistence, but sometimes the medical profession's persistence against all odds, that it just doesn't feel right. The number one reason for critical care nurses to leave the field of critical care is moral distress. They don't feel good about the care that they're giving.
Is this just something that's a problem in this country?
I think it's accentuated in this country because we Americans really do believe that if you just work harder, we can fight disease. We think that it somehow, if we just go to the next referral center, many of which are, by the way, within the five boroughs, then by golly, we can find a specialist who will keep us alive. It just doesn't work out that way.
But you also say New York is not particularly bad in this regard. You also give an example in terms of costs that at UCLA Medical Center in Los Angeles, the average cost of medical care during the last 2 years of life was $93,842. And at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, it was $53,432. We're talking about $40,000 difference here. Can you explain that?
There is a certain influence of the culture of where you practice. Things are done here because, by golly, that's the way we do things here. There really is regional and institutional differences. Sometimes within a city, you can go to the Dartmouth Atlas of Healthcare Use and look at the various hospitals in New York City and find dramatic differences in costs in the last year of life. What's really important here is that it's also been shown that those costs don't extend life. The people who with congestive heart failure or cancer don't live longer at UCLA than Mayo. The outcomes are actually the same, in fact.
But Mayo's doing it differently?
Mayo is doing it differently. In fact, the outcomes in terms of people's comfort, their communication scores, their quality of life are actually higher at the centers that tend to have less costs during the last year.
Because they stress hospice and palliative care?
Well, partly because it's actually not even that.
Is that cost saving?
It's because they actually do individualized decision making so that it's person-centered. And yes, palliative care and hospice are part of that. But it's not like you can throw any discipline at a problem and make it better. We have to focus the whole healthcare system on human beings. It is true, though, that New York State actually ranks 49th in the use of hospice care through the end of life. And given that hospice has been well shown to improve comfort and quality and actually to help people live longer than people with the same conditions who don't get hospice care, you would think that New York State should be advocating strongly for increased use of hospice care. This is something that, there's a wonderful Hospice and Palliative Care Association of New York State. They have a website. You can go to it. You can find out where the hospice programs are in your town and county and advocate for your loved ones to get it.
You write about some patients who decide to live with their cancer instead of fighting against it. Can you talk about why they make that decision and why in any number of cases their life actually was prolonged as a result of that decision?
First of all, I don't think you have to make a dichotomous choice between treatment and good care for people's comfort and quality of life. There's a full spectrum of what amount of disease treatment people will accept, from absolutely nothing, I just want to live with this and let nature take its course, to keep me alive at all costs until my EEG is flatlined for a week. I mean, I see people literally at both ends of that spectrum. The best care is the care that fits for the individual and family, really ascertaining what their values and preferences are and applying that to the treatments and healthcare outcomes that are best. But we don't have to withhold care for people's comfort and quality of life, their pain, their breathlessness, their emotional, social, even spiritual well-being. Studies have shown that concurrent care, meaning disease treatment and the sort of work that I and our team does in hospice and palliative care, not only improves quality, people actually live longer.
You write about a patient named Darren whose story, you say, illustrates an essential tension that clinicians, patients, and families encounter when they're trying to make sound medical decisions in life-threatening situations. Can you tell us about
that? It's true.
Case?
Well, Darren was in the ICU for a very long period of time and was dying. We worked with his family intensively to support them through what was really the most wrenching and difficult times of their life. He came to the brink of death, but as and the readers will find out, he actually was able to survive this excruciatingly long ICU stay. I just got a letter from him. They got the book about 5 days ago, and I got a letter from Darren's parents saying that every time they see him smile, they realize what a gift our medical center gave them and our palliative care team contributed to him being able to survive and them being able to get through this intact as a family.
But one of the things that his case illustrates is that every patient's situation is unique. And it's been my experience that if you go to a doctor and you have this condition and they ask you 10 questions and you say yes to 6 of them but no to 4 of them, then they discount the possibility that it could be what it really is, that we have a kind of a routinized approach to medicine.
And that's part of what's wrong. You know, medicine needs to be sophisticated enough to get this right. We need to walk and chew gum at the same time. We absolutely have to be able to bring the best diagnostics and therapeutics to people's diseases and their organ systems and their complex physiology. Got to get the pharmacology right. But we can take care of whole persons and help them sort through medical decisions. Nowadays, we talk about something called shared decision making, where decisions are collaboratively made with patients and families in an informed way, in accordance with their values and preferences, acknowledging that there's some biologic realities that, you know, we can't do everything and keep people alive. That's different, and that's part of the state of the art. In the 1960s, when I was growing up, you know, shared decision-making happened when a doctor shared his decision with you. These days, we work together with people to get it right.
A listener wonders if the best way is to question your doctor about his or her end-of-life view so that you can make sure you're in agreement.
Well, something like that. I think it's important to ask, you know, what do you do for the end of life? Will you follow me through the end of life like your friend's oncologist did not? Are you willing to work with palliative care and hospice? How are you going to support my family? If a doctor, you know, gives you the wrong answers to all that, I strongly suggest you get another doctor.
In the play Wit, she requests a DNR, do not resuscitate. And when her machine flatlines, they all come in and they try to revive her. And the nurse is yelling, don't do it. She doesn't want this. Don't do it. But they do it anyway because that's the procedure.
It's wrong. When they know that that somebody wishes to be allowed to die gently and they do that, that's just wrong. You know, in some states, that's medical battery.
Some of the issues surrounding end-of-life health care have become political hot issues. We mentioned the death panels. What about the debate over physician-assisted suicide? Has that clouded this whole area of end-of-life care?
I think it has distracted us from the real deficiencies that we could actually correct. It's so distracting. So every interview I'm asked about assisted suicide, you see it fills the airways. It's partly what has inflamed the conversation and really made it a toxic area. You know, I frankly think we progressives have been sold a bill of goods. I happen to be a lifelong proud political progressive. I don't buy that legalizing physician-assisted suicide is somehow an extension of our personal freedoms. I just don't think that people have to kill themselves to become dignified.
In a society, even if they feel that they're in terrible pain and they have really no hope for the future?
Well, you know, medical care, if somebody's in terrible pain, medical care is already failing them. And the decision to suicide is a pretty close, careful decision that medical treatment has nothing left to offer. But we now make people suffer at the end of life. We pauperize them and their families for being seriously ill and not dying quickly enough. We lay terrible burdens on families. I don't think in this social setting, and we don't teach doctors how to care well for people through the end of life, in this social setting, calling legalized physician-assisted suicide an extension of personal freedoms is a little bit like calling Sophie's Choice in Styron's novel an expression of free will.
Now, there are a lot of people who in the past have complained that when they were in terrible pain, that the doctors did not want to increase the levels of painkillers because it would make them into addicts, even though they were on their last legs.
So that has to be clear. This is where advocacy is and activism is needed. What you just described is medical negligence, pure and simple.
But the doctors are saying that they're doing it out of good intentions.
They may be doing it out of good intentions. You can be well-intended and still commit medical negligence. That is bad medical treatment.
So how do we change this? Is this something that the AMA should be doing? Is this something that our legislators should be getting involved in?
You know, really and truly, we need a new social movement. Honest to goodness, I'm 61 years old. When we baby boomers were having babies, we took back the beginning of life. We said that pregnancy and childbirth needed expert medical attention, but the need for expert medical attention did not make them primarily medical events. Now at the end of life, and just think what we did. I mean, when I was growing up, fathers weren't in a delivery room. There were no such thing as birth coaches. Nowadays, we worry if fathers aren't in the delivery room and if somebody comes without a birth coach. Now it's as the boomers age and are facing our own end of life, we have to take back this part of the life cycle. We have to say that illness and dying absolutely require expert medical attention, but are first and fundamentally personal experiences for us and our families. So we need to take back the end of life. We need to insist that our medical schools get it right. We need to begin insisting that there is adequate staffing in our nursing homes so that our parents and grandparents have someone to answer the bell when they are wet and need to get to the bathroom or at feeding time. You want to preserve somebody's dignity? You don't have to write them a lethal prescription. Have somebody answer the bell when they need to get to the bathroom, or have somebody help them to eat. Treat them with the dignity that they have.
Ira Bayek is the director of palliative medicine at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon, New Hampshire, professor at Dartmouth Medical School. His previous book, Dying Well, was featured prominently in 60 Minutes, won a Peabody Award, in fact. And his latest is The Best Care Possible, A Physician's Quest to Transform Care Through the End of Life. It is published by Avery. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's really been a pleasure to be with you.